right, here we are. Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for joining us here once again at Red Eyes TV. It's good to be back with you. I'm Henrik. If you're new, check out, of course, our websites, redeyes.tv and redeyesmembers.com. But we've got a number of channels as well. Hope you're all doing well out there today. I have another great interview here lined up for you guys. Hope you're going to enjoy this one. We have Raw Egg Nationalist with us. He is the star, if you remember, from the recent Tucker Carlson documentary, The End of Men, that ran on Fox Nation. Obviously, this was before, you know, Tucker was fired, when we were still on the network. We might talk about that later, too. We'll see. But anyway, Raw Egg Nationalist is the author of multiple books on health and fitness, and a figurehead in the Raw Egg Nationalism movement. His latest book, The Eggs Benedict Option, is the ultimate guide to the Great Reset Plan for food. Definitely something I want to talk about here today. And how we can resist it and usher in a new and instead pro-human future. He's also behind Man's World magazine, and we'll talk more about that later on in the show. Mr. Raw Egg, thank you for joining us. Good to see you.
It's an absolute pleasure, Henrik. It's really nice to talk to you.
Fantastic. I'm very glad to have you here. Thank you to Dan Lyman, by the way, who connected us here. I appreciate that. So shout out to Dan if he's watching. All right. Tell us, Raw Egg Nationalism. Tell us about the name. How you came up with it?
Well, I didn't actually come up with it. So it was a hashtag that was circulating on Twitter round about the beginning of 2020. I was a lurker at that point, actually. I'd been lurking on Twitter for a little while, following people like Bronze Age Pervert, having a good chuckle at their tweets, but not really getting particularly, not really being particularly active. But then I saw this hashtag, Raw Egg Nationalism, and people were talking about slonking, which is the technical term for consuming raw eggs in large quantities. And I got behind it. I tried it myself. I thought, oh, this sounds great. And it had an immediate effect. I thought, wow, this is incredible. I mean, I've been in fitness for a long time. I've always been in good shape. I've always been a sportsman and all that sort of stuff. And I was a martial artist. But the raw egg slonking really seemed to take my gains to the next level. And so I got behind that, and I rebranded myself as the Raw Egg Nationalist, not really thinking very much of it, just that I sort of wanted to represent raw egg nationalism. And then, well, everything just started to go a bit crazy in the summer of 2020 when I started when I published my raw egg cookbook, Raw Egg Nationalism in Theory and Practice, which started out just as a free PDF and then became a paperback, and now it's a hardback. Like a glossy coffee table cookbook.
Nice.
So, that's the origin story of Raw Egg Nationalism. It's humble origins, but it's really developed into something of a phenomenon now. Actually.
It has, definitely has. So, so fitness, you know, health, nutrition, food, these kinds of things. Now, was that, you said that was your primary interest? What about the adjacent topics to that that naturally follows? Because as soon as you're into these topics, especially in this day and age, you realize, wait a minute, they're trying to control our food, they're trying to ruin our health, they're trying to make us weak and limit, essentially, our nutrition. There's been a number of proposals throughout the years. I remember Codex Alimentarius was one of these that were circulating. Organizations like the UN and stuff wanted to regulate, you know, supplements and various things, natural health foods and stuff like that. And so then you become exposed to this world of like the establishment and those who are seeking to control us and stuff. Was that something you already were familiar with? Or was that something that came in the wake of being interested in health and nutrition and these things?
I suppose it was definitely something I was aware of, but perhaps the extent to which that is the case wasn't as apparent to me then as it is now. I mean, my book, The Eggs Benedict Option, which I wrote in the summer of last year, almost a year ago, well, over a year ago now, it came out in July last year, so it's been out for a year. That book is about the history of food and social control and how the two are inextricably linked or have been, certainly throughout history. So I start the book by discussing Plato's Republic. Now, there's a very interesting, very short but short section of Plato's Republic at the beginning of book two, where Plato has Socrates and his companions Glaucon and Adamantus talk about the origins of society, and they sort of are talking hypothetically about how societies arise and you know, you get a basic division of labor and all that sort of stuff. But then they get on to talking about diet, and Plato's Socrates makes the suggestion that an ideal harmonious society in which, you know, everybody is happy and there's no strife, anything like that, would be a society of vegetarians, that you would actually have, you would have to, as a, you know, the rule of the society, you would have deliberately to prevent the ordinary people of society from eating meat. And that actually, if they did eat meat, what would then happen is that they, he says something like their passions would become inflamed and they would want more. And then what you would have to do is you would have to have a much more complex society in which there were police and you had an army and you had more territory and all sorts of stuff like that. So it's a very, very ancient, what I'm trying to get at with that when I made that the preface of the book is that it's actually a very, very ancient idea that you can change the way a society, you can change what a society is and how the people in it behave by altering its diet. And you know, that the idea that actually maybe, you know, a vegetarian diet is most suitable for a harmonious society is one that resonates now, right?
Because yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's what's being promoted is plant-based diets. You know, we have to change our diets fundamentally. We have to abandon animal products and we have to eat, a plant-based diet, plant proteins, soy, things like that, and maybe alternative proteins like farmed insects and plant-based meats and maybe some lab-grown meat too. But fundamentally what we need to do is we need to get away from eating the animal foods that our ancestors have eaten since time immemorial. And what I'm saying in the book is that actually this plan, this food transformation, is the basis of a radical social transformation which we call the Great Reset, and which its architects call the Great Reset. So I think you can't understand what is going on today, this sort of globalist plan for social transformation, without understanding the food supply and what the globalists want to do to it.
Yep, that's right. Yeah, I remember first when I heard the term, the Great Reset, I realized it was a multi, you know, pronged release, if you will, at the same time. It was actually, well, now it's King Charles, but it was Prince Charles at the time, that released a video on the Royal Family, I think the YouTube channel is called, or something like that, which kind of launched the Great Reset term. And then it was either literally the same day or the day after, something like that. It was Klaus Schwab talking about it at the World Economic Forum. And I think they did a co-joint press conference or something like that.
Yeah,
I forget exactly.
Did.
Was quite enlightening that it was so. I mean, it's always been kind of an open conspiracy, to be honest, but this was like a slap in the face with the whole thing. And it was during it was like first year of COVID or something, I believe, right? Wasn't it?
Yes, it was. So that was, I mean, I talk about this in the book. This was the World Economic Forum virtual summit at Davos in 2020. So
that's right. Yeah.
Barely a couple of months after the beginning of the pandemic, then you have world leaders, Prince Charles, Klaus Schwab, all saying, I mean, they all attended virtually, so it's, you know, it was like Zoom calls, but they all said, using exactly the same language, same terminology, we need a fundamental transformation of society. We need a great reset. We need to build back better. The pandemic is showing us that, you know, the previous system was totally unsustainable, and we have to have a total change in everything we do, the way we eat, the way we live, the way we work, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, one of the themes of the book is that, look, this isn't a conspiracy theory, or this talk about the Great Reset. It's totally in the open. The book is properly sourced with references, so I'm not working on hearsay, or rumor, or anything like that, or wild inference. It's actually from published documents that are out there that you can look up if you want, and you know, you can go on YouTube and you can watch them saying it, or you can read them saying it on the website or whatever. I mean, they delete stuff from the website occasionally, which is interesting, and they deleted the Welcome to 2030, you know, the very famous they deleted that, but that's still up on Forbes, so you can still read that, or you can go on Wayback Machine and find it. But they do have a habit of trying to cover their tracks when they get very negative publicity, as they did with the Welcome to 2030 thing. But yeah, it's all out there. It's not a conspiracy theory at all.
No, of course not. Yeah, that's right. And it was, I think it was a Danish. I just looked at this, Ida Auken. She had actually written,
yes,
back in, what was it, 2018 or something like that? And interesting, even the picture they used on the World Economic Forum was a picture of Gothenburg, you know, close to where I grew up and stuff like that, they were using for that. But it was like, you'll own nothing, you'll be happy, and you'll have no privacy, I think she had added, but I think that was a step too far for the, you know, the famous tweet from the WEF later on.
Well, what they did as well was she ended up issuing a disclaimer that was then added to the article. So there was this disclaimer at the beginning that said, "Oh, this is my sort of fantasy of the future. This isn't what the future is going to be like. This is just me spitballing some ideas about." You know, what the future could be like in one particular universe, but then they just decided to delete it when you know, so many people were sort of outraged and were saying that it was just appalling and horrendously dystopian, which of course it is.
It is. And then coincidentally, of course, they're all working in that direction, so it's nothing to do with anything. It's just a proposal, but we're all trying to enforce those kinds of policies, whether it's in business or government, infiltrating, you know, cabinets, like Klaus Schwab famously said in one of the presentations. Man, there's so many golden clips that we've played over the years, in the last couple of years, you know, of them just admitting right in the open. And it's almost, and I think you raised this point in another interview I heard too, but it's almost like it's a cartoonish version of like a globalist, you know what I mean? It's almost, one wonders, is it a distraction? But then one realizes, no, they do have sway, they do have a tremendous amount of influence and power, and a lot of the big corporations and even countries, they, for some reason, they go to these NGOs and these groups, they go to these institutions and they follow suit, they do want to cooperate with them, and they listen to them in many cases as well. I mean, right now, I think we're overseeing essentially an overhaul of the financial system as well, which I think is going to come at some point, where they're seeking to remake capitalism, as they say. Klaus has talked about stakeholder capitalism, and they want to take it in a completely kind of different direction. So this is, they are not having a couple of proposals over on the sidelines here. They're at the dead center of power in most of the West, at least.
Well, what I think is interesting about Klaus Schwab is that he is in many respects a caricature, and I do think he plays it up. I mean, there's that famous picture of him wearing that sort of strange kind of Emperor Palpatine costume, if you remember.
Yeah.
I think that he definitely plays up that role. And I think in certain respects, what that does is that gets people to think that he is basically Emperor Palpatine, and that he's much, much more powerful than he is. I think he's a confidence man, but that doesn't mean that any of this stuff is any less real. What I think is that, it is a kind of distraction, and it makes people focus on him rather than on the way that power is actually working in this globalized system.
Right.
So, you know, people think, oh, if we could just get rid of the World Economic Forum and get rid of Klaus Schwab, none of the Great Reset wouldn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that that's the case at all. I don't think that's the case at all. You know, like, if somebody, you know, if Klaus Schwab had a heart attack, then, you know, the Great Reset wouldn't happen or something.
Right, right. Exactly.
It isn't like that. I mean,
yeah.
Our world leaders, philanthropists, captains of industry, celebrities, politicians, members of royalty, you know, they are all part of a globalized, globalist elite. And what you actually need is you actually need real political change. You do need someone like Donald Trump for all his faults. I mean, the reaction that he elicited from his opponents, from the globalist class, was one of basically of sheer terror and panic. And they've spent 4+ years now doing their best to destroy him, 7 years, however long it is. And they are doing their absolute best to ensure that he won't be able to run in 2024. And I think that that shows us the way to actually to fight this. You know, it's not about for instance, what Jordan Peterson is doing, which is setting up a counter WEF. I don't know if you've heard about
this. Yeah, I have. Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, what we need to do is we need to challenge the World Economic Forum narrative. You know, we can beat them with better ideas or something like that. And that's just, to me, then that just seems like he's just pissing in the wind. You know, it's that's not what we need to do. Most people are horrified by the ideas that you'd find in Welcome to 2030 or you know, any one of any other you know, World Economic Forum think pieces and all of this kind of rhetoric. You don't need really to convince most people. What you need is you need to give them some political representation that isn't compromised.
Yes, exactly. And you know, Klaus Schwab is like, you know, he's a PR man, obviously, and he's a guy who, as you said, even if he disappears, it wouldn't really matter to the bigger thing, because all of these powerful institutions and you know, corporations now, some corporations have more power than nations now, obviously. But what's curious to me is why they all agreed to sign up to it. There's no requirement. They don't have to do it. It's kind of like the ESGs, or whether it's the diversity, inclusion, equity, and things like that. And there are a couple of people recently, you know, they talked about things like the corporate equality index run by the Human Rights Campaign and things like that. There are beginning now kind of almost social credit scores for corporations and things like this. And a lot of people want to signal and stuff like that. But as we've seen over the last few, I mean, 6 months or so, maybe, that's not always conducive to actually, you know, success when it comes to, you know, making more money and things like that. We've seen Bud Light. There's finally beginning some pushback against some of these policies. And it might not be, you know, a perfect pushback. It might not be ideal. And it's not like, again, as you said, that doesn't really make, oh, people stop buying Bud Light. You know, all the problems are not going to go away. But it's at least it's an... a little bit of a tiny beginning of a pushback, that they realize they can't just, you know, indiscriminately get away with all of this and sign up to some of this madness. But what do you think? I mean, why do anybody sign on to these things? Is there somebody forcing them? Do they realize that they just have to do this? Is it just simply down to virtue signaling, and they want to do you know, what looks good in other people's eyes? What do you think it's about?
I'm not entirely sure. I think it's probably a lot of different things happening at once. I think there are a lot of different factors going into this. But it is definitely very interesting. It is very revealing that, you know, these companies that go woke don't necessarily go broke. And I think that is quite eye-opening, really, because what you realize in many cases is that actually these companies don't actually really even need to sell their products anymore. Something fundamental has happened to the way that capitalism works, that actually a company can abandon its constituencies, its traditional, you know, consumer bases, and essentially give them the middle finger, and yet still remain enormously powerful, still have access to vast amounts of money. And some of that, a large part of that is to do with, or maybe all of that is to do with these ESGs, you know, which have to do with the way that that financing is given out now by these big corporations, by these big hedge funds, whatever they are, whatever you'd call them, asset managers like BlackRock, you know, where they're forcing an agenda, Is it Larry Fink? No, it's not Larry
Yeah,
Fink.
No, Larry Fink, that's right.
Yeah, Larry Fink. As Larry Fink said, you know, we are in the business of changing people's behavior.
Forcing people's behavior, yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a complicated story. I mean, in many ways, I think it's probably, there are probably some analogies with, you know, what's generally called the long march through the institutions, the sort of cultural Marxist takeover of institutions beginning in the 1920s and the 1930s, when thinkers like Antonio Gramsci, you know, realized that actually they weren't going to be able to cause a revolution in the manner described by Marx in his works. What they were going to have to do was take over institutions and subvert them from the inside in a gradual process in order to effect a kind of slower revolution. And I think that there's obviously been there's obviously been something like that taking place for some time in the world of capital, not just in the universities and the public institutions, the bureaucracies and stuff like that. I think something fundamental has definitely changed in the world of capitalism, and the sort of traditional focus on just selling products to consumers. Actually, that doesn't explain the behavior of corporations anymore. It's a big puzzle, and it would be interesting for somebody to provide a really compelling, a really detailed explanation of how and why that has happened.
Yeah, it's true. It's definitely like there's been some agreements behind locked doors in dark lit rooms, you know, with the cigar smoke in them, where they're like, yep, this is the direction. I think they, on some level, a lot of the people at the establishment, the elite, whatever you want to call them, have kind of also realized where this is going, both demographically and maybe because they're behind some of that, but obviously, at least in the West, we're knowing that there's birth, rate decline. And then they've tried to made up for that, you know, with immigration. They open the borders. They think we can keep this afloat a little bit more. They need the headcount. They need more bodies, essentially, and the kind of the, really, the debt-based economic system and the models we've had. They want to just kind of keep continuing and running that. Mm. And at some point, I think they've realized that is not going to work anymore. Even countries that are modernizing are experiencing the same things that we have in the West. They're having fewer and fewer children. And in fact, in some of the third world countries and stuff, it's even happening faster than it was happening in the West. We might actually plateau demographically at some point, but there seems to be a super quick decline for, you know, second and third world countries in some cases, as soon as they modernize and urbanize. But anyway, I think they've realized this is not going to work anymore. We have to overhaul the whole thing. I think this ultimately is down to an insurance policy of sorts for them. They want to be able to continue to live the way they live now, but they've realized this is impossible to bring in every single person on the earth into this kind of, you know, Western-style system and stuff like that. So I think they've opted for us to have bugs, for us to get into pods, for us to put on the VR headset while they have, you know, their swimming pools on their yachts, eating the finest food and things like that. What do you think they're up to here?
Oh, I definitely think that is how it will work out if they get their way, certainly. And one of the big things I talk about in the Eggs Benedict option is the original agricultural revolution that took place, let's say, circa 10 to 12,000 years ago in the Near East. And that was the transformation that saw the emergence of actual fixed field farming for the first time. And then on top of that, the emergence of the first states. So the early sort of city states of Mesopotamia, Ur, Uruk, Lagash, and other sort of small city states like that. That process is, in many ways, I think, well, what I say in the book is that actually it's the original Great Reset. And what you see with the agricultural revolution is masses and masses of ordinary people who were formerly hunter-gatherers, herded into these big cities or city states to become agriculturalists. And then you have a very, very, and all they're eating basically is grains. And so they're incredibly malnourished. They're unhealthy. They die young. They're very susceptible to infectious diseases, to epidemics, which sort of ravage the Near East. But what you have on top of that then is you have a very, very small elite who are basically the ones who've shepherded all the people into these cities. And they still continue to live the kind of lives full of hunting and feasting, and you know they have access to the kind of finest food, whereas the peasantry, as it were, are all eating grain slop. And I think that's actually, in many respects, an analogy for what is going to happen in the future. I think, you know, with a world population of 10 billion people eating a plant-based diet, of course the elites are still going to be eating meat. There's no question about that. They're not going to give up eating meat. I mean, they will have their secret farms, or their hidden, you know, their hidden places where there are still mangalits of pigs and you know, the finest Aberdeen Angus beef, and they'll still be eating wonderful wild seafood if there are still fish in the sea by that time. I think that is definitely that is definitely the way that it will go down, because that is the way that it has always gone down in history. That is what generally happens. You have a narrow elite exploiting these transformations off the back of a large, you know, mass of people, a large populace. But
yeah,
I mean, how they will do it, I don't know. I mean, I've written recently about this thing called climate migration. They're calling it climate migration, right? Where they're talking about, so there's this insane book that I read. It's called Nomad Century by this woman called Gaia Vince, who is like a female Noah Yuval Harari, basically. She's like a science popularizer. And I wrote a review of this book for the American Mind called The Day After Tomorrow. But basically what she says in the book is that catastrophic climate change now is inevitable. There's nothing that we can do now to avert catastrophic climate change. What that means is that the most populous areas of the planet, which are around the equator, Africa, you know, Asia, the Middle East, Latin America, they're basically going to become uninhabitable by the end of the century, like totally uninhabitable. If you live there, you'll die. So what will happen is that billions of people will be at threat from, you know, existential threat from climate change. So we have a choice. We can either invite all of the people who live in the global south to come to the global north now in an orderly manner, so that we can sort of minimize the suffering, or we can deal with it in 30 years' time when they'll just be coming all at once and we'll be totally overwhelmed. So she actually makes an economic case for why this will be beneficial, as well as a moral case for why it will be beneficial. And she talks about the fact that it will be, you know, nobody in the future will be white and all that sort of stuff. And she makes some very very knowing kind of comments. She knows who she's prodding. She really does.
Right.
It's quite a revealing book. But this is now the narrative, right? That catastrophic climate change is going to mean that billions of people have to come to the West. Not millions, but billions. And Al Gore was talking about it at the World Economic Forum summit at the beginning of the year. And it's a narrative that is gaining, that is actually gaining, you know, sort of
traction.
Gaining, it's gaining traction, and it's really sort of start. You're hearing politicians talking about it now.
Yeah,
William Hague, conservative, who was the leader of the Conservative Party in the early 2000s, a conservative apparently, wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago, I think, for the Daily Telegraph, a British paper, where he was saying, look, this is the age of migration. You're just going to have to get used to it. We are going to have to accept millions and millions of people. And that's it. there's no choice. And that is how it is going to be presented, is we have no choice. But that, I think, increasingly, the idea that, you know, the entire population of the global south will have to come to the global north, to the developed world. I think that is how they're going to do the Great Reset if they do it. That is the justification. And in the book, Nomad Century, then she says, look, we won't be able to rely on nation states. We can't have traditional political structures to deal with this. We will need a global government. And her book has been promoted by the World Economic Forum. She's been on their podcast. I mean, she's written for them since sort of 2015. So she's very definitely affiliated with them. And I think that is the narrative that we should be watching now.
Yeah, I've seen this too. I've heard about it. They are talking about it's always this Jedi mind trick that it's inevitable, right? It doesn't matter how it's bound to happen. There's nothing you can do about it. So the only thing we have to do is to try to make it, as you said, as orderly as possible. That's why they, you know, even the UN Sustainable Development Goals, they talk about regular and orderly migration, right? In fact, even 10, at least 10 out of the 17 goals of these Sustainable Development Goals contain targets and indicators that are directly relevant to migration. And so this has been one of the, you know, in the their books, in the game plan for quite a while. Here it is right here, right? Reduce inequality. Mm. They say facilitate orderly, safe, regular, and responsible migration and mobility of people, including through the implementation of planned and well-managed migration policy. So it might be this that, okay, they might not like that we're seeing, you know, thousands and thousands of people pouring over the border, and it's true that that is obviously creating kind of a right-wing nationalistic response as well. People don't like to see this. So they're trying to find a way of still doing this, but not have any of the effects of doing it, which is impossible. This is totally insane. But somehow they got hubris. They think they're going to pull this off and do it. But no, this is the climate thing is interesting because, you know, right now as we speak, number of articles, just a couple of examples here. They talk about the incredible heat right now. It's, oh my God, the Earth is being scorched. Nearly at the limit for human survival, the Washington Post had. Reuters, Europe battles heat and fire. Sweltering temperatures scorch China and the U.S. One more. Heat wave in Europe could be poised to set a new temperature record in Italy. And this is how they always scare us into submission. And try to, if you don't go along with us, if you don't do what we tell you to do, if you don't bow down, you're all going to die, right? That's kind of, it's simple, but it, in many regards, it works, right? It's simple, but it works.
Yeah. Well, of course it does. Fear is, as Frank Herbert writes in Dune, right? Fear is the mind killer. Fear makes people lose their minds, you know?
Yeah.
And if you can make people terrified, the world is ending. The world is ending. You know, you're gonna be swallowed up in an enormous conflagration. Then people will look for a savior, and people anyway are so programmed to be reliant now. And this is something that I talk about with regard to food and fitness and whatever. You know, people are reliant on other people for their own, or particularly institutions, for their well-being. You know, I want to lose weight. I've got to have a jab. I've got to take, a pharmaceutical company has to make a pharmaceutical product for me to be able to lose weight. You could pile up instances of the ways that people are just totally, totally dependent in that regard. But buried at the end of, or not buried, but at the end of that article that I wrote for the American Mind, then I talk about the fact that they have already established legal precedents for climate migration. So there was a ruling at the UN, I think it was last year, maybe the year before, where the UN basically decided that, the UN Human Rights Council, I think it was, decided that it is that there's a legal basis basically for climate migration. So if somebody is fleeing their country because of climate change, you can't send them back, basically. So they're definitely getting ready for this. I mean, things like that is the prelude, I think, to what they're really going to unleash maybe in 5 or 10 years time. I mean, it's already happening now. There's already a migrant crisis in Europe, but we're talking tens of millions or maybe even hundreds of millions of people, in which case that's going to make the 2015 migrant crisis look like a day at the park.
Yeah. Was it John Kerry? This is also one of the big globalist conferences recently. What about tens of millions or hundreds of millions of people pouring over, you know, from sub-Saharan Africa into Europe because of climate? And it's almost I felt they're also using it as kind of an extortion, right? Do what we say in terms of on the climate front, or you'll be flooded by, you know, hundreds of millions of people.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think there's a threat in a lot of what our rulers and would-be rulers have to say. You know, it's like you do as we say, and you'll be all right. You'll get to keep your stuff. You know, you'll be
right.
You'll be okay. You know, we'll protect you. But if you don't, I mean, look, that was the rhetoric throughout the pandemic, right? It was like,
you stay
in your house, you wear your mask, you come out of your house and line up to get your jab, or people are gonna die. We're gonna have a dark winter.
Yes.
A winter of
Yep.
whatever it was, a winter of death,
winter of
and
death.
Suffering, and
yeah.
You know, it's people respond to that. I mean, when you are trapped in your home and you're being bombarded every time you turn on the television or the internet, you're being bombarded with propaganda about you know, the sort of people dying in the streets and dying everywhere, and you know, if you leave your house then you're at risk and blah blah blah, then people are going to respond to that. And of course, as it turned out, then actually government psychological warfare units and psychological warfare units of the military in Canada and in the UK, and probably also in the US, I'm sure, were involved in coordinating the messaging, in fighting disinfo, which is, you know, this phrase that they love to use, fighting disinfo on social media. It was a very, very well coordinated, well, almost a military campaign, I suppose. I mean, it was a war that was waged
on us,
a psychological war that was waged on ordinary citizens, and it worked for the most part.
Yeah, that's why I think it's too good for them to let up. It's going to be something else tomorrow, or you know, a new version of this. But even the burn thing, I just want to share that real quick, because it said they've talked about wildfires and stuff, and I saw this was kind of interesting note on this. Bjorn Lumbori, I think it is, on Twitter said, "Stop the panic. The world is burning less, not more, because humans adapt to and suppress fire. Likely even less will burn in the future. Climate is a problem because likely even less burn without temp rise." It's a bit kind of oddly written here, but the point remains that the number of wildfires have gone down. Isn't it always the same with this? You look at the stat, oh no, it's actually going down, but the fear and the hype is you know, driving up, so it feels like it's more. I mean, look at the charts now of the temperatures. Not even dark red now, it's going into black, almost purple, you know what I mean? It's just total rot, like death, you know. They know what they're doing.
They do. They understand at a very basic level the importance of symbolism and messaging, and just something, yes, like you say, changing the colours on a weather forecast is enough to make people at an unconscious level, and probably on a conscious level too, think, God, things are getting really bad. I mean, you know, it's July here. Well, it's July where you are too, but it's July and it's been raining for the last week here. I mean, it's
right.
No sign of record heat waves here. I mean, I wish there bloody was, because I'd like to go swimming. I'd like to go swimming in the sea, but, yeah, they know exactly what they're doing. They are masters of manipulation.
Yeah.
And the thing is that they know now that the crisis is the way to do it, right? The crisis is the way to create the state of exception where they can change the law, they can change fundamentally the way that we live, you know. I mean, there was no precedent whatsoever. There were no legal precedents for what was done during the pandemic, but because of the crisis, then they were able to do it, and people actually didn't question until it was too late, until it had been done. I mean, there was when Boris Johnson in this country initiated the first lockdown, it was illegal. I mean, there's actually been like proper legal analysis of it. It was illegal, but because the police decided, or the police were in agreement, then it was enforced, even though it was illegal.
Yeah.
And then what they did was, I think it was maybe a week or however many days later, they passed a law that retroactively made it legal.
Brilliant.
Yeah, that is actually what happened. But it's crises. Crises, I think. We are going to be in a perpetual state of crisis. That is what they will use. That's what they will use the climate crisis for. It's a planetary. It's a planetary crisis. It's not a crisis in any particular country. You can't get away from it. You know,
it justifies their global governance system. You know what I mean?
We must.
We must have it. We have no option. You know.
Yeah. It is that simple. I think that climate change is fundamentally being used to force social and economic transformation on a global level.
Yeah. And of course, then you do have the crazy things, right? The war on carbon right now. You have huge investments going into things such as carbon capture. Bill Gates is just one of the names behind this. There's many others. They've done spearheading programs in Iceland. They are building them in the U.S. I think other countries are involved in this right now as well. They're basically going to suck in air And these big plants essentially are going to capture the carbon, and they're going to turn it into stone. However the process happens, I'm not exactly sure. But then they're going to bury it underground, right? And just think of, you know, we talked about food and control of food and things like that. I ran a clip just the other day on one of our shows from AGA, one of the big corporations, and they're doing a promotional video about how they're using carbon dioxide, obviously. This is, you know, no shittums here, but, you know, many people don't think of this. They're using carbon dioxide in these greenhouses that they have to increase yield. You know what I mean? And it keeps things cleaner, keeps parasites. It was all these, you know, positive, beneficial things. And then you begin thinking, you know, you put together, okay, they're decommissioning farms, like in the Netherlands, in Ireland, they're killing cattle now. They're, you know, the most insane stuff, where they're putting plastic bags on top of cows to capture their farts. They're putting masks on the cows to filter the air, to capture the methane, you know, their burps, essentially. Mm. And the most absurd, crazy stuff right now. But you put all these things together, and between the war on carbon and stuff, you realize, if they succeed in this, we might be in for the biggest, you know, starvation catastrophe that we've ever seen. This is total madness when I look at this. What do you see when you look at what they're doing?
Yeah, I mean, it looks like madness to me, and I don't think that we really know what's going to happen. I don't think they certainly don't know what's going to happen. Because we've never done anything like this before. This is totally unprecedented. And I mean, reducing carbon in the atmosphere on a planetary scale is a recipe for disaster. I mean, it's happened before in the past. It happened, well, they reckon that the little ice age that took place in the sort of early modern period, 16th, 17th century, when there was a small ice age in Europe, that was directly the result of the discovery of the Americas, basically, and the destruction of the Amerindian populations in the Americas, because you know, they were, it actually turns out that the supposedly pristine environments of North America, the plains and the forests and all that, were actually very, very closely managed by the Native Americans. So they were burning land all the time to encourage certain types of plants rather than others, they burned land to do with hunting. They burned large swathes of land, basically. And what happened was, when millions and millions of them then died off from European diseases, all that burning stopped taking place. And so actually what happened is that the carbon in the atmosphere then decreased. And well, what happened? You got a little ice age. And there's similar thinking about the conquest of Genghis Khan as well. You know, that he killed so many millions of people and so reduced the production of carbon dioxide that actually it had effects on the planetary climate. So yeah, I mean, I don't know what effect it's going to have, but it certainly could be catastrophic. And you've got to remember that they're not only talking about capturing carbon. This is something else that I've talked about. They're talking about terraforming, essentially, or geoengineering, you know, where they're going to do things like release silicon dioxide or sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere to reflect more sunlight, so that the earth is cooler. And there are private companies doing this now. I mean, I wrote a piece again for American Mind about it. There's a company called Make Sunsets, which has been releasing weather balloons full of sulfur dioxide, and you can actually buy what they call carbon, I think they call them cooling credits, that's what they call them, cooling credits. So you can pay them, it's a startup run out of California, you can pay them and you can pay for the payload of a sulfur dioxide balloon to reduce the global temperature by, you know, whatever millionth of a fraction of a degree, and you're going to see much more of this. I mean, the US government has talked about it as a strategy. It's been investigated by the National Academy of Sciences or whoever, It's been talked at, it's been talked about at the UN. The World Economic Forum talks about it all the time. They're constantly posting think pieces about geoengineering and, you know, putting a giant mirror between the Earth and the Sun so that it will reflect back, you know, a significant proportion of solar radiation and all that kind of stuff. So you've got all that kind of stuff going on as well, which has the potential for disaster too. I mean,
yeah.
Part of me thinks that they do a lot of this just because they have to create new places for money to go. I mean, fundamentally, then I think that the world economic. I mean, I'm no economist, but fundamentally, then I do think it's probably certain that there's big trouble in store for the global economy, maybe soon. And I think yeah. that what they're doing in part with all of these carbon credits and decarbonization and all that kind of stuff is they're creating new channels for money to flow through, because, you know, they have to keep the money has to go somewhere. They have to find ways to continue the flow of money, because maybe, you know, consumerism is not going to provide the sort of flow of money that it once did. I think it's very complicated. I think it's very, very complicated. But there's no question in my. I mean, obviously, people believe in decarbonization. You know, you have most people are zealots, or, you know, most people who really believe in it actually genuinely are zealots, I think. But there are probably other people who just see it for the scam that it is, but are quite willing to go along with it because they can make money. I mean, it should be obvious to any really intelligent, informed person that wind turbines are a scam, for
right.
instance.
Yeah.
You know, but we keep building them.
Exactly. Of course. Yeah. I mean, environmentally, it's horrible. You can't even recycle them. There's these huge dumps now with just parts of wind turbines lying around, and we don't even know what to do with it. But one thing I want to squeeze in real quick is this. I think this is what King Charles, at the time Prince Charles, talked about, even Klaus Schwab, you know, overhauling of the capitalist system, got to base it on something new. It's interesting that happened, it's a couple of years old now, but the New York Stock Exchange had launched a new asset class, which basically is based on nature itself, and even the processes in nature. And I think it's also going to eventually be related to how, you know, they're going to modify processes in nature or utilize them or even patent them in some regards. There are obviously type of GMOs now where, okay, you can't patent a tomato, but you can change the genes in it slightly and then you can own it, you know, kind of thing. And then you can tell people that whether they, you know, grow it, eat it, and so forth, you have to pay a license fee essentially for that, to those who own this new tomato, calling it something else. But they talked about this, a patch of land or water somewhere, they try to make that this has an intrinsic value in it, and we have to tie the economy to it. So anyway, they're spearheading and trying this out right now at the New York Stock Exchange. And it's kind of crazy when you think about it, because I think it will eventually turn into this where nature itself will not become something that we are in and part of and we can get access to, but it's going to be seen as a you know, money generator, and so therefore we have to either improve it or you can't, you know, be in it. You have to have you know, the only certain little spots here and there that we can go into nature and things like that. I can see an endless you know, slew of crazy things that they wheel out here in the coming years as we go up to 2030 to try to justify you know, saving our lives, you know, and seeing themselves as the good guys as they're doing this. You know, none of this might happen at all. None of it might, you know, kind of come into fruition. We might come, you know, we might head for some collapse or something before that. We don't even know, right? But the point is, they're trying all these kinds of crazy ways. And at some point, I think you're going to see an overhaul of the financial system, and you're going to see global currencies, most likely central bank digital currencies, being put in its yes. place. And they're going to make the switch when the crisis, you know, have peaked, so to speak. They'll make the switch. We'll be in this new system, and they'll say, "Look, we saved you, right? We didn't have a horrible collapse, and you know, we're the good guys here."
Yeah, I think that's exactly what's going to happen. I think that the central bank digital currencies are a key tool of control. I mean, You know, you can they're talking about it already. You can program them. You can say, you can only use this money to do so and so. You can only spend this money on food. You can only spend this money on heating. You can only spend this money on clothing or, you know, some other consumer good. Oh, you can't spend this money at all because you said something bad on Twitter.
Basically.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean, that is what is coming. We've seen it in China already, that kind of thing, that sort of system, social credit score system. I think that is what they're planning for the rest of us. But to go back to what you were saying about genetically engineering and food products, you know, that's a key part of the Great Reset is corporate ownership, total corporate ownership of the food supply, and you achieve that by introducing new forms of technology like genetic engineering. So you create products that can be owned from top to bottom by corporations. So, you know, you can't, I say this all the time, you can't patent an egg, but you can patent a plant-based egg. You can patent the process that goes into making a synthetic egg that's made from soy protein and canola oil and various different texturizers and colorings and flavorings and artificial ingredients. You know, you can patent that product. And so if you say to people, you can't eat eggs anymore, but you can eat plant-based eggs, then what you've done is you've handed control over that particular foodstuff to corporations, to the corporations that make it. And that's the same with lab-grown meat, you know, this which is animal cells grown in vats. That is a proprietary process. So, you know, you can't patent cows, but you can patent lab-grown beef. And this is just something that is taking place at every level of society, but it's particularly noticeable in food because it's something that we're not used to. I mean, what you will see is you will see the disappearance of the small farmer. That's one of the things that you will absolutely see. That's what's happening in Holland right now. They're getting rid of the small farms or just the normal farms. And what you will see is you're going to see just a total corporate consolidation over agriculture and food production. And they talk about it. This isn't a conspiracy theory. This is in the World Economic Forum's policy documents. It's in the UN policy documents. And if it isn't explicitly spelled out, it's implied, because when you talk about feeding a global population of 10 billion a plant-based diet that's mainly made up of grains and legumes that are genetically modified, that is what you are saying, because genetically modified products, genetically modified plants, are owned by corporations.
Yes.
You know, five or six corporations now own basically all the seeds on the planet, and companies like what was formerly Monsanto but is now, I think, a part of Bayer, then there are all sorts of incredibly stringent conditions attached to using their genetically modified seeds. There have been various exposés of this from time to time, what people call the Monsanto mafia. Basically, you sign a detailed contract when you buy seeds from Monsanto. You're not allowed to give them to other people. You're not allowed to save them at the end of the year. So you have to go back to Monsanto to buy them again. You have to use certain products on them. If the seeds end up sort of getting blown away and sort of landing on someone else's land who isn't allowed to use them, then they'll take you to court. And there's all sorts of shady stuff, and they have this sort of private police force that they send out to check that you're, you know, acting in conformity, that you're not breaking the conditions of the contract. So it is fundamentally about corporate control. It allows corporations a degree of control over their products that they previously didn't have. And of course they want this. Of course they want it, because it's more money for them. It's more control.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the future. That is the future that they want. And that's what I talk about at length in the Eggs Benedict option. And it's coming unless we do something about it.
It's true. We're going to take a break here shortly, and I want to talk more about that in part two. Obviously, what do we do? How do we respond to this? And you know, things like that. We have to get there, but it's vitally important to diagnose the problem and kind of just have an overview of what it is that we're really faced with here as a motivator for us to get off our asses and do something about it. Start organizing, getting together with friends, and building community and networks and. Offering something perpendicular. I prefer that even to parallel, to be honest, because parallel sounds like we're doing the same thing but just off to the side, but something that, you know, is completely different. But anyway, so we got the Eggs Benedict option that's out right now. You can get it at Antelope Hill. You can get it, I believe, at Amazon, but get it from yes. Antelope Hill. Then you have, we didn't talk about it much yet, but we can certainly talk more about this in part two, too. Man's World, tell us about the magazine you're behind.
Yes, yeah, Man's World is a magazine. It's in its 11th issue now. I started it at the beginning of 2021. It's imagine a Playboy that wasn't posed. It's kind of, that's the kind of the mission statement is to be what Playboy perhaps once was and should be now. All the best writers on the right, some famous, less so, others less so, all sorts of kind of anything that should be of issue to and an interest to a man today, then we cover on Man's World. Essays, interviews, style, all sorts of stuff, food, fitness, everything. It's all in there. It's and there's nothing like it. There's nothing like it on the market at the moment. It's really it's really something quite unique, I think.
Now, do you have both digital and like a hard copy version, or how is it distributed?
So what we do is there's a website which you're on at the moment, which you're showing people, and you can read individual articles from the magazine on the website, or you can download the actual magazine. It is like a digital magazine. There's a paperback digest that I publish on Amazon that has a selection of essays and pieces from each issue of the magazine. Can download from Amazon. And then what we do at the end of each year is we publish an annual, which is like a hardback, exactly like a Playboy annual, like Playboy used to publish at the end of each year. And it has a selection of some of the finest essays and content from the year, with exclusive stuff as well, in this amazing hardback coffee table book that you can, you know, give to your dad or give to your uncle or someone and secretly start sort of red pilling people. So it's but we are working towards getting the magazine itself out in magazine form soon. That will be happening soon.
Nice.
That will be on some selected store shelves very soon, I think. It's a real phenomenon. It's really taken off. I mean, I started well, it wasn't a joke when I started it, but I certainly didn't think that it would be. So we've just got a Twitter account now, so we haven't really been using that Twitter account for long, but it's really growing now. But yeah, I started it just as an experiment, really, because I thought, well, wouldn't it be great if we had one place on the dissident right, whatever you want to call it, on the right, where people could post content like this, and, you know, rather than just people writing on their Substack pages and for other, you know, just posting tweets and stuff, couldn't we have a publication that actually sort of had a soul and a kind of coherent message that could serve as a vehicle for all of us to work together in the same direction?
Oh, absolutely. No, it's vitally important to have these kinds of publications, and again, having in this day and age, not that it would happen with your virtual copy, but this is another thing that you know, another layer of worry, basically. We have now AI and things like that. They can actually change things on your screen in real time, like sentences, you know, they can normalize things. I mean, you know that they're reprinting certain works now, of course, like Roald Dahl's books. They're adding, you know, PC terms in there and stuff. And that's one thing when you just like kind of reprint it and send it out or whatever. Okay, Grant, you can look for older copies or something like that. But when it's on screen, There's even plugins to browsers now where they take phrases or whatever and you can instantaneously change in front of you. Or like, you know, I'm just waiting for the time when like Apple does this on an iPhone or an iPad or something like that. Oh, this is, we don't like this term. We're going to change that right in front of your eyes. You won't even notice, but you know, you won't see it. So that's why it's vital. That's what I'm saying, that vital to have, you know, kind of hardcover or things like that. So as Mr. Roig said, you have on Antelope Hill, actually, the 2022 annual, Man's World Annual, available. If you want to check out that, I highly encourage that. We got to mention, you, of course, have your Twitter account, BabyGravy9.
That's me.
If you want to follow Raw Egg Nationalist there. Otherwise, check out the books, of course. We're going to keep talking more about this. We'll have links down below, by the way, too. A few guys, you can reach them from there easily. But great convo so far. Stay with us, everybody. Stay with us, Mr. Raw Egg. We'll take a short break there, and we'll be right back. Thanks so much for checking out our interview with Raw Egg Nationalist. We are going to continue in part two right now over at redicemembers.com, odyssey.com/@redicetv, or subscribestar.com/redice for our subscribers and members. In the second part of this interview, we talk about the Neolithic Agricultural Revolution, kind of the first reset, as Mr. Raw Egg mentioned. It's a frankly, a bizarre development in some ways, but it did happen. It is what it is. We talk about what potentially did go on at that point. We also talk about food production in general in the current age. You know, the dangers of GMOs and genetic engineering. They're patenting all these, you know, plants and vegetables and things like that now. They're also going over into the meat production. They're even using mRNA on pigs and cows now. This is crazy how they're extending this. We also talk about a new asset class that the stock exchanges are creating. They're doing a dry run right now with the New York Stock Exchange. But basically, they're seeking to monetize and capitalize on nature in and of itself, on the natural processes. It's very bizarre. Also, we discuss how people are attacked for being basically far-right extremists who are into fitness and healthy foods. Basically, we're all bigots. Now, this is basically this is a very bizarre step for them to take, to be honest. But it's clear that we are now the normal ones and that they are the mutants. And they kind of want to make sure that we know that. It's not at all negative for us. It's actually good that they're painting themselves into this corner. We also spend a good deal of time addressing what we should and what we can do also. Why are we not seeing a great reject and resistance on a mass scale yet? Well, maybe we never will. Maybe it's going to be down to a minority of strong, brave, and resilient people to continue to carry on the fire of civilization as the current one crumbles. And I can't help to feel good riddance. Don't miss part two of our conversation with Raw Egg Nationalist. Join us over at redicemembers.com. You can also sign up at odyssey.com/@redicetv. or subscribestar.com/redice. Whatever you prefer. It's only $10 a month. You can save a lot of money if you sign up for a longer subscription. If you do a 2-year one, you almost get somewhat like 35% off. Do sign up, support our work. We are only here because of you. We don't have any sponsors. We don't have any huge deals with corporations. We don't have angel investors or venture capitalists coming in and supplying us with endless amounts of cash. We are listener supported 100%. If you want to see more, if you want to help us grow, please consider getting a membership. For those of you who want to donate, you can do that as well at redice.tv/donate. Also want to say thank you today to our executive producers, T. Lothrop Stoddard, V. Miller, Resin Revolt, Good Luck Lap, Jake, Red Pill Rundown, Chalky Milk, French 47, Mark Smith, No One Jeeves, President of Bunga, Mongoose, William Fox, Angry White Soccer Mom, The Second Wanderer, Operation Werewolf, The Ride Never Ends, Francis Parker Yockey, Dillbob. We also have Last Place Simp, Joseph Hart, Purple Haze, and JP. Thank you, guys. We can't do it without you. Also, thanks to our producers, Mr. Walker, 696, Johansson, Leroy Dumont, Snorkpup, Eyes Open, Mr. Lemry, Urinu, Obadiah Hexwell, Single Action Army, and George Porge. Thank you, guys. We appreciate all of you. If you want to get a membership tier that has producer or executive producer credits associated with it, you can get that at redicemembers.com or Odyssey or Subscribestar, whatever works for you. If you want to shout out at the end of the show, special thanks and a little bit more sway, I guess, over us as well. We'd love to have your guest suggestions, topic suggestions, and things like this if you are an executive producer. Thank you for watching. Part 2 coming up right now after the break. We'll see you guys over there.